Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This podcast bonus was originally recorded November 2019 at the home of Robert and Nena Thurman.
Okay, greetings. Today is Yoga Day. Or rather, really, I have two topics on my mind. And I've been traveling in Bhutan, and I'm very happy to be joining you all again today in today's podcast. And of course, I went to Al Gore's training in August on the Climate Reality Project. I have been, of course, obsessed as a great-grandfather and a grandfather. I don't mean I'm a great-grandfather, I'm a lousy grandfather. Just like I've not been that good as a father or anything, because I've been workaholicing away here for the last 50 years, teaching people. And I am a grandfather, and I had the joy of going to the Climate Reality Project training, which Al Gore offered last time in Minneapolis. And he offers it only infrequently. And the next one, they all said, all the lovely people who work with him in the Climate Reality Project, the next one is in Japan. And he's done it internationally. I think the figures are 20,000 in the U.S. have been trained as Climate Reality Project leaders, and 5,000 internationally have been trained as Climate Reality Project leaders. And that means Australia, China, Japan, Europe, et cetera. I think probably even India. I'm not sure of the exact. I don't know if they publish a list on the Climate Reality Project website. You could check it yourself. But it's been a very important effort that our president in exile, who should have been our president in the year 2000 until 2008, really, that would change history if he had no Iraq invasion and climate, dealing with the climate in a more gradual way 20 years ago than the more catastrophic and emergency way we have to deal with it now. But anyway, he did a great impact anyway of informing lots of people around the world, his wonderful Inconvenient Truth. Although the Murdoch climate-denying propaganda machine, more than the climate-reality-denying politicians, because it's only the Murdoch machine that keeps their ignorant fan base loyal by lying to them, which seems to be a mystery to other people in the media as to why Trump's people, for example, are so endlessly loyal and so much terrorizing the other Republican politicians. It's really simple. It's that they get a false view of reality from that propaganda station. That's simple as that. They all watch it, and they all are told that what's happening is not happening, and that what's not happening is happening. And so they're all completely in another world, and that's as simple as that. That should be illegal to lie on public television. It should be illegal to lie on Facebook, and it should be, therefore, you know, censored. Lies should be, it's not really censoring that, it's correction ahead of time, not afterwards when people won't pay attention to the correction. Sorry for that digression, but you know me, my age. So I'm very preoccupied with the climate. Then Greta Thunberg, that was in August, on my birthday actually, which was wonderful. And Al Gore is the most greatest, gracious person. He really should be president now. He could run now and I think win. But for some reason, whatever, he's not. And then Greta Thunberg's amazing advent. I should have heard about her, I guess, a year or two ago, but I didn't. And it really got into my consciousness with her great trip across the Atlantic and her visit here, the young people. Although then I'm catching up as a, you know, ivory tower grandpa who is not paying attention. So anyway, I took my two of my grandchildren to that, who are the right age, and who were able to be free, and one godchild. And I was very, very happy that they were there. And I don't know what they can do in the middle of their school and their young careers, but they will—they have it in their mind. And they, you know, when you take the Climate Reality Leadership Project as a youth leader, you do commit to making the subject known, being the Paul Revere's, which we're trying to do. So I want to do some podcasts on that. I'm going to be doing that. I have to figure out how to use Al Gore's wonderful instructional slides, which have a certain restriction about recording. I have to figure out how to use the info on them, let's say, in this way, without using the slide or something. I have to figure that out. So I can't do that so much today. But that is so important. We mustn't forget, you know, Greta Thunberg's cry. You know, Greta Thunberg is like a Tibetan oracle, medium, which means that some of the Tibetan natural spirits, spirit of mountains, spirit of the earth, spirit of sky, they speak through a human being that they choose, who are often kept enshrined in a monastery as monks or nuns. There are some female ones as well, but some lay persons. And then they speak they become mediums for these spirits. And this is the spirit of Mother Earth herself, I think. That's why it was so extreme that Greta Thunberg, even at 9, 8, 9, and 10, she couldn't eat. She kind of had a breakdown, which is typical for a shaman or an oracle medium, where they just break down because the way the grown-ups are behaving around them is somehow not appropriate to reality, and they're hearing a deeper voice from nature coming through them, or from deities coming through them. And then those deities and those natural forces put them back together after some time, and then they are able to channel that, either in a trance state or, in Greta's case, straight ahead, which people then call autism, or they make it as if it was something wrong with her, when meanwhile she's focused on the fact that everybody is behaving in a crazy manner. You know, our society is behaving crazily by driving around and pumping oil and gas and thinking that's just fine, you know, and something else will happen later, when it's clearly shown to us by those who are measuring the effects of this on reality that we're sinking our continents and we're polluting our air beyond where it could be polluted, you know. So we're having these storms and terrible things. And she's the one who's sane. And it's autism just means she's focused on this fact of the reality of things, and we're all distracted from that. So actually, we're the ones who are being psychos, not her. But so we must remember that. But now let me go to yoga. I am so thrilled about the yoga movement in the world, and it is India's really great gift to the world. And the Yoga Sutra level of the gift, which is where it seems to come from as far as modern Indian teachers of yoga, the great Patabi Joyce, the great Iyengar, and their great teacher and so forth, who kind of got it started in India, and whose students like Richard Freeman, John Campbell, Eddie Stern, all of them are the ones that are, and the Jivamukti people, etc., directly and indirect students. They're the ones who are making this worldwide movement, and it's a wonderful movement. You only have to know that Lenin and Stalin made it illegal in the Soviet Union. They made yoga illegal, to realize that yoga is some very important thing for the individual's free self-expression, the individual's health, the individual's connection to reality in a certain way. It's really important, and yoga means connection. That's what it means. And it comes from yoke, that we have the English word, to yoke your oxen to the plow, you know, to yoke yourself to a mission, you know, meaning you harness up to do something. That's what yoga means. And although there's two strands in Indian history, there's the Vedist strand, what I call not Vedic, but Vedist strand, those who worship the Vedas and their secondary literature. And there's this Shramanist strand. Shramana means, like shaman, actually, maybe the source of the word shaman, but shramana means, I call it, people translate it as ascetic, because it does come from someone who's tired of the ordinary life, like an autistic person, thinking that it's like not really well-founded. And but then they wander looking for a better solution. So it's called ascetic in the sense that people think that it's a good thing to stay in the household, to make money, to have to make money, pay taxes, maybe serve in the army, have a family, pay tuition. If you're a woman, bear children, which is a big job, huge job. And they think if they, someone denies themselves those joys of those labors, either they're earning the money and the fighting in the army or the laboring of the bearing the children and bringing them up and bringing the making the food and the whole thing. If they think those things are something you're depriving yourself of, those pleasures, then they call it asceticism. But really what it is vacationism. So I call a great shramana, Buddha was the great shramana, I call him the great vacationer. And vacation is perfect. Vacate means to empty yourself of your usual preoccupations and go and take a break and sort of be there on the beach or be there on the, in the mountains or by the lake or whatever it is and like think about what it just means to be alive or don't think about anything because you're just being alive. And then you will inevitably, when you do that, you'll think about, well, what is the purpose of being alive and where, and how long will I be alive and all the things that shramanas do. So vacationer is perfect, actually. I really should insist on it. I kind of always tell it like a joke to my colleagues because ascetic is so stuck in people's minds. But vacationer is really correct, actually, for shramana. And when I say shramanism and not just Buddhism, now among those shramanism, Buddhism was by far the biggest movement and the longest lasting and the only one that was a huge Indian export, you could say, from the Indian sub. First of all, it was an export from within North Indian area where Buddha came from to the, all the other nations on the Indian subcontinent, which are numerous. And then it was an export to East Asia and Southeast Asia and Iran, Central Asia, and indirectly possibly toward the West, and certainly influenced Christianity over the year, maybe through Alexandria, maybe through Mesopotamia. There are different theories, but they're not much pursued by European scholars because they have they are still stuck in the idea of Mediterraneanism. And remember what Mediterranean means, middle of the earth, you know. So the Westerners think that they, although they're the far western part of Eurasia, that they're the middle of the earth, you know. So they don't look for influences from Asia, which they had from ancient time, pre-literate times. You know, the archaeologists find changes in the shape of an axe head or something from China to the Danube are interactive within two or three decades before there's any literary visible like sharing, you know. Just, you know, tribes wandering around, you know. So anyway, yuj, to yoke. Yukti in Sanskrit means reasonable, reasoning, something fitting. And it, so it just means connection yoga. So the other great shramana movement was Jainism. There were four or five other important ones, probably 100, but there are four or five that are well known, which have not made much of an impression since the time of Buddha's Buddha and Mahavira of Jainism. But the two, Buddhism and Jainism, have lasted well, although Jainism didn't export itself from India, really, and it never became such a big movement in India. But it still, on the other hand, it made up for that by lasting through the Muslim and European Christian occupations of India for 1,000 years. Jainism lasted because the Jains were the jewelers, they were the bankers, because they were so strict on their notion of nonviolence, which they shared with the other shramanists, the Buddhas, but they were so much more strict about it that they wouldn't plow. So they didn't do agricultural work, so they had to live in cities and they became controlling influences in the exchanges in cities that are vital to whoever's ruling. And they're still thriving today. You know, they're wonderful, nice people, the Jains. So those two movements, anyway, that their contribution to Indian civilization is ignored. And their yoga is ignored, and their contribution to the concept of yoga has been ignored. And sort of the Vedist one, as it then has developed into what is called Hinduism. Well, you have to understand that Hinduism was a term that was used by Arab historians to describe whatever religious thing was going on in India. They did not really that much discriminate between the Hindus and the Buddhists. Although at the time they first began to invade, only the Buddhists had monks. The Hindu, the Brahmins, the Vedists, they didn't have monks. They had celibate students, but then everyone was, had to go through the stage of life of marriage and household. That was part of the Vedist four stages of life. And so they didn't have monasteries. But then after the Muslims had wiped out the Buddhist monasteries, which they saw as useless to the society, to the wealth production that they were ruling over, they never had monks themselves in Islam. All the priests in Islam were always lay people. And so that's part of your contribution to the Indian culture from which yoga comes is obscured in India, and they didn't realize that. Now, the key point I want to make here, which is why I'm so excited about it myself, is my view of the world is what is called non-dualist. And I didn't originate that, and I don't even fully understand it. I don't pretend to, because I don't pretend to be enlightened fully. A little bit, yes, of course, I admit to. I've been a little bit like ruined by becoming a little bit enlightened as far as being a certain way. And so the thing is that non-dualism means, derives, I consider, and I think it derives from Buddha's discovery of emptiness. It therefore doesn't come from Vedism, although the Upanishads, which were the end of Vedism, the Vedanta, they were actually anti-Vedic, but within Vedism, very beautifully. Indians are so complex and their language is so wonderful intellectually that they were able to be sort of non-Vedist Vedists. You could say Vedanta, because anta means the end or termination of. So it doesn't mean the subsequent thing. It means the end of the Vedas. So because the Vedas originally were just rituals, because the Vedas people thought that the gods controlled your fate and destiny. So the way you controlled the gods, or you got them to be nice to you and not to be bad to you, and so you could have progeny, victory, and wealth, and long life, was you offered them gifts through rituals, and then they gave you a break. You know, they were pleased by the, you propitiated them. Let's say you drew near to them, you pleased them. And so that's what the Vedists were. And then the Vedanta means that's a lower knowledge. That's not the way to really deal with things, because the way you yourself are is what causes your fate. What you do, what you think, what you say. But this was an innovation in the Indian world by Mahavira and Buddha, actually. The Shramanists are the ones who really did this. And they may be basing themselves on an ancient tradition that could have been there as early as the Harappan civilization in the second millennium. But anyway, that got kind of pushed south or wiped out by Aryan invaders coming through Iran from Central Asia due to some massive mega climatic changes, mainly that the vast Central Asian steppe became less habitable and the river valleys became more attractive, and the domination of agricultural workers by these chariot wielding fierce people from the nomadic reaches, which have always bred fierce and strong people, and because they live in a certain difficulty of subsistence. And later, thousands of years later, the Mongolians, you know. But it was the so-called Aryans, who were kind of whiteys, unfortunately, that did that. So I'm saying that the non-dualist view, though, comes from the scientific discovery of emptiness, however many people rediscovered before Buddha and Mahavira, or who interpreted it in different ways. So I mainly know the Buddha way. And the Buddha way was that that emptiness doesn't mean that the world doesn't exist at all. In fact, it verifies that the world does exist. But what it means is it exists as a relative thing. Everything in it is relative. There is no absolute outside of it that deals, makes it exist. So it's a rejection, not of deities, because there are deities, according to the Buddha and Mahavira, but a rejection of an omnipotent absolute one who yet acts relatively to create a relative world, but somehow is apart from it. That's too incoherent, and that is rejected. And then in the Buddhist literature, I don't know about the Jain literature, whether they have a similar story, but in the Buddhist literature, the story is that the being that was thought to be the monotheistic creator, Brahma, told Buddha, I'm not the creator, and I'm not omnipotent. I'm a very powerful deity, and I was like one of the luckiest beings in the world, and I'm also nice, and I'm happy, and I try to help people. But in a way, I don't really exactly know how to do it, because I'm not either omniscient or I'm quite knowledgeable, super knowledge. I have kind of super knowledge, but I'm not omniscient and I'm not omnipotent. So, and the reason he told the Buddha that through some intermediary and eventually himself directly is that he wanted Buddha to teach, because he wanted Buddha to teach people that they are all responsible for their own fate. In interaction, of course, and there are powerful beings who can also affect their fate, and it's important to relate to them in a nice way. And there are also bad ones who are quite powerful who can also make trouble, and they have to relate to them in a nice way. But ultimately, one has one's own fate in one's hands, and one can become free of this kind of being compelled by either good or bad people and become enlightened. And then somehow, what's nice about that, Buddha discovered, Brahma didn't really know that. But Buddha discovered, or maybe Brahma did because he remembered with his vast knowledge other beings who had become Buddhas before Buddha. So I want to give Brahma a break there. But it's possible to understand everything clearly. And that doesn't guarantee omnipotence, because part of understanding everything is that other beings are free. And you cannot force them into this or that. You cannot do this. You can't even if you kill them, you haven't quieted them down, because then they are reborn. Because there's the spirit, the subtle level of the mind, or the spirit or the soul or whatever you call it, is a continuum, also very relative. You know, Buddha talked about selflessness or soullessness sometimes. And he said everything, that has to do with his emptiness thing. Meaning that there's no soul or spirit, that is a fixed thing that's absolute, that's disconnected from everything. But that doesn't mean there isn't a super, super subtle thing. Westerners who had denied the fixed soul to get away from the Christian church, you know, threatening them with hell all the time, they took it as meaning there's no mind and no soul, and you just live, you're just a material, biological robot, and then you die. And then they transfer that sense of absolutism that originally they had about God and then about the soul, they shifted that over to nothingness, which makes them just as fanatical in a more subtle way and reckless, actually. The super fanatic theists, monotheists, are reckless because they think God will save them if they just do the right thing to God. They can be horrible killers, and then they just say, I love you, God, or your emissary, Jesus, or your prophet, Muhammad, whoever it is, and then you'll make me happy. And so they're reckless in a way of thinking that an absolute is working for them. And the modern ones are reckless in the way they think an absolute is waiting for them. They don't think nothing is doing anything for them, but they think nothing is waits there, and that's what they've absolutized. So then they think they just become that, and they get rid of the illusion of being a responsible living being. So Buddha's discovery, which was scientific, it had to do with investigating everything, including the subatomic, which apparently through really the highest level of yoga, you can, without a machine, you have your amazing brain, and you can discover the nature of its own cells and its own atoms and its own subatomic energies, and as well as its masses. You can understand it all. So that was his great achievement as the greatest scientist of that era that is still marking our era. And so I believe that non-dualism. And that's what, therefore, what non-dualism mandates by there being no separate absolute in anything or relevant to anything, it mandates that we take responsibility for our interconnection. So that means we yoke ourselves to the way we interconnect with things. That's ultimate yoga. So the ultimate truth is our interrelationships. And that is of an inconceivable kind of almost totality, which is indescribable and inconceivable in sort of linear terms. And yet experientially, we can feel it through a state of complete open-heartedness. So that knowledge becomes sensitivity, empathy, compassion toward other beings, and makes us, if we become a Buddha, an agent of well-being to all beings automatically. And so all that energy that we humans often invest in some kind of an absolute because we're scared of the way that things are when they connect to us, because often they connect in a harmful way. Like we stub our toe, that's connecting to the chair leg in such a way that it's very painful and maybe breaks a toe bone if you do it hard enough, you know. Or whatever, you know, a tidal wave comes, or a hurricane, you know, the wind, the fire, or forest fire. In other words, interconnections, we're scared of it, so we think there's some absolute we can go and be disconnected. And we have created that sort of a mental delusion that if we think it's absolute, it will be. But actually, luckily, our language can tell us that absolute means disconnected. And therefore, you can't connect to what is disconnected. And so therefore, even if there were some disconnected thing that was like, you know, howdy doody, ultimate or something, it would have no effect on us, because if it connected to us, it has to be relational. Because, you know, the only connecting means relating. You get it? It's very simple, actually. It's not even complicated. But it's hard for us to give up the idea that there's something we can escape from it all to. And the what Buddha discovered is that we can escape to love and compassion. We can escape to being so committed to everything that we kind of identify with all of it. And so then it can't harm us because we are all of it and there's nothing else that can bump into it. That's a weird way of putting it. But you put it all kinds of ways because you know that you can't describe it, actually. Finally, it's indescribable. But it's right in front of our face also, because it connects to us. So yoga, I think, really originally and primally meant yoking your life energy to your ultimate purpose in life. And so therefore yoga, you know, there could be a yoga of being fanatic. You could be yoked to the fanaticism that you're going to leave the world and go somewhere else with God. Or you could yoke yourself to the fanaticism that you could just blow your brains out. You could hang out for a while, do whatever you feel like, and then if it got too bad, just kill yourself. And then you're yoked to the nothing, which is your reality. So you know, in a way, it's not like you can choose to do yoga. We are yoked to whatever we think. Yeah, and we're yoked to our body, for example, and we're yoked to the world and all this. So therefore, there's two kinds of yoga. There's one kind of yoga which even the Buddhists, and the Jains, the Shramanists, and the Vedists, in their Vedanta is non-Vedic Vedic way, non-Vedist Vedist way, which was Vedanta, they yoke themselves to getting out of this problem of suffering, thinking that there was a way out of it. For example, the Yoga Sutra, which seems to come from that time when the Shramanists were making their impact and the Vedas were absorbing that impact by being non-Vedas Vedists or Vedantaists. And the sort of conservative wing of that revolutionary mid-first millennium BCE era. They yoked themselves to escaping from the world. Chittavritti nirodha. You know, to terminate the functioning of the mind. That's to obliterate yourself. and Nirvana, in what it was more usually called in its original time, Nirodha, which means also cessation. That word Nirodha was also the word for Nirvana. So Yoga Sutra was very much in line with the anti-Vedist or non-Vedist movement of the Shramanists. Nirodha, cessation of suffering. And yet, those were for people who were not able to conceive of cessation of suffering while staying interconnected with the world, because they'd had too many painful interconnections, if you follow me. They were too sensitive to the potential pain of interconnection. So they thought that cessation of suffering meant cessation of all interconnection. And so they had a notion of Nirvana as someplace outside the world, and the Vedantists had a notion of Nirvana or Nirodha as being one with Brahma, who they absolutized as a monotheistic deity who was outside the world. And the world just was a dream. You know, they had all kind of great language for it because they're so brilliant, all of them. But they were stuck on that one thing. And that may also well come from one special virtue of human. I don't think I'm all against even fanatics. Fanatics are great. Although I don't like to be run over by one if they have a tank. But fanatics also are humans. And humans have this amazing ability to create worlds with their minds, because they've become they've evolved from other animal forms and things to be so intelligent and so sensitive and develop language which is dualistic. So in the dualistic language, binary, let's call it then, say binary language, if you have a word for relative, which is everything you've ever experienced, it's whatever has related to you, inside, outside or inside, then you're going to have a word for the opposite of that, which is going to be non-relative or absolute. So then you're going to think that must be something because I have a word for it. And we all have this wrong feeling in our mind that there's an identity inside us. And remember the word identity, Latin, idem means the same, and iti is an abstract suffix. So identity means sameness, an unchanging fixed thing that is Bob Thurman, me. That is somehow I can withdraw into when Bob Thurman's body or Bob Thurman's thoughts or Bob Thurman's ears or sounds, you know, language is being attacked or something. I can withdraw into some absolute Bob Thurman hood, some entity inside. So human beings developed this amazing way of having a helpful dissociation and a helpful psychosis, where they could pretend that something wasn't happening to them, that was painful happening. This is human. That's a kind of wonderful thing. You know, nature of human hell, as described by the people who threaten humans with it, which includes certain types of Buddhists as well as Vedists and Western monotheists, Abrahamists, is that you don't have any way of freaking out from the pain, and you just keep going on the pain. There's no, you don't pass out, you don't go unconscious, and you don't dissociate. So there's a special human ability to dissociate. I'm not against it. So therefore, Buddha taught people like that, and he knew that they would interpret his notion that there's a way of being in the world but not of it, that is to say, in interconnection but totally happy about being interconnected, because so loving of every piece of it that you can ignore the suffering as far as your own continuum goes, and you can interact with others in an optimal way to ameliorate their own sense of suffering, since they don't know that that's the direction to go. They're still trying to get out of it by withdrawing into some realm that they've imagined. Put it that way. Okay? So that creates dualism. And those early Buddha, the Buddha, not early Buddhists, but the renunciative or dualist Buddhists and the dualistic Vedantaists, like the Sankhya and the Yoga people, they're into yoking themselves to escaping in a very effective way. And they wrote that marvelous Yoga Sutra that you all like and love. Chittavritti Nirodha. And you think Chittavritti Nirodha means that you will learn to stop worrying. And that's one of the mental functions you will stop. But you don't quite realize that. And then you wonder, why don't they describe the asanas in this Yoga Sutra? How come there's no, you know, you know, downward dog, there's no peacock pose, there's no, not all these marvelous things. How come they don't have that? You know, in the, even Surya Namaskara is not in the Yoga Sutra. Why? If that's where yoga comes from, how come they don't have any of the things we constantly are doing when we're practicing yoga? Well, because Chittavritti Nirodha is also getting the chitta out of the body. Because the mind, chitta just means chit comes from to compile, to accumulate. So chitta means a compilation. So it's the mind sort of stacking up memories and experiences and organizing different sense impressions and things like that. So mind, when it's the coarse mind, as we call it in Buddhist science, coarse mind is always interwoven with the body. So to stop its vritti, which means just it's turning, it's evolving, it's functioning, you have to get it out of the body. And so naturally you don't care about the body except to put it in a posture where it, you won't notice it. And strangely, the best way of doing that is not lying down, savasana, sleeping, because you don't notice your body when you're asleep. You go somewhere else, supposedly, or you just go into unconsciousness. This is a very key thing that people that we all misinterpret what happens to us when we're unconscious. But anyway, I'll come back to that maybe. But the point is, there's this idea is to permanently get out of the body. And then they were also had the problem that they were not so crazy as to think that there wasn't some subtle continuum, even in their unchanging identity, where it would plant itself in another body in the future. This also came up around, probably came from the Shramanists, and it was part of beginning to notice that the mind itself is relative, and there is no non-relative place in the mind. It's just an imagination that there is, but there is no real non-relative place. The mind itself is a totally relational stream. So therefore, but I'm the reason, so I say I'm a non-dualist, right? So therefore, I'm forced to like yoga. Because if I don't follow that idea, then after 400 or 500 years after the time of the Yoga, or maybe 300 or 400 years after the time of the Yoga Sutra, India had matured more as a society. They'd had the Emperor Ashoka, who promoted the idea of nonviolence, although his empire was made with violence, but then he repented that. Then he promoted widely nonviolence, and he didn't try to conquer anywhere outside of India or expand further in within India and the subcontinent. And he promoted widely the Dharma, the Shramanist view. And so therefore, India got more mature and people got more into making life better without thinking they could go off somewhere absolute. And this diminished the militarism of India and it diminished the male chauvinism, not totally by any means, but appreciably. So women were more free and therefore there was less need of this sort of mendicant group that Buddha organized as a way of countering the patriarchal society, quietly and slowly rebelling against it, and Mahavira joining him in that, and the followers of Mahavira. And so then the non-dualism could begin to be more appreciated directly by people. The people who were into dualism and tried to get out of the world, into the mind, often discovered, most of them discovered that was when they went into meditative states that seemingly of seeming total dissociation and total disconnection. They kind of came up out of them, like when you go to sleep, and even though you dream, you then wake up though, you know, usually. So you go to sleep in a much stronger way where you actually leave the body. But then since even the mind's continuum itself is a stream, it eventually encounters other things and it becomes conscious of itself as part of a larger current. And so a lot of them then came around to the idea of finding out how to be free of suffering within a world where others still are suffering, which is what the non-dualists are about. So then the body itself becomes an important instrument of relating to others. What is the body for? Our bodies are for relating to the world around them, around the mind. And the mind realizes it can't be completely dissociated from everything. So it has to relate. So then it evolves different kinds of bodies. Now, if it wants to relate to the world by just eating whatever is in front of it, it will have a body that's mainly a mouth and teeth and a very strong digestive system like a crocodile. And it'll go chomp, chomp, chomp through the world. And then it'll eventually get chomped by somebody, and then it'll be reborn in another egg and continue to chomp. You know, and then we humans have been through all of that, and we have this really weird body that interrelates with others in a very strange way, with these digits, the way we have sexuality, the senses all in the head, mostly except for the skin. I mean, we are really strange creatures. And we somehow managed to carry around this incredible supercomputer that can actually try to figure out what the world is about, you know, through knowledge, through experience, like scientists, like Buddha did. So anyway, after about 400 years, then the non-dualism emerged. And with the non-dualism, the fact that the body is the incredibly useful thing that humans have evolved, that interacts with other humans and other and nature in a very effective way, that can be incredibly destructive, actually more destructive than some kind of animal that just can only exist in a certain niche of eating this, you know, and being eaten by that. But instead, we humans can just be very complicated how we relate, and we can destroy everything we now have noticed as a planet. That's what's happened now. We've realized that two ways, one by thermonuclear war, and two by carbon recycling, wrongly trashing pollution, we can end all life. So our own as well, you know, our own embodiment, that means. Or we wouldn't end all life, because even everybody dies on Earth, their minds would go ahead and be reborn on other planets or wherever it would be, or in some slag heap as some weird creature in this one, depending on how we went out. So, because continuity is the rule in nature. There's no such thing as radical discontinuity is another sneaky kind of absolutizing of something, which doesn't happen as far as we've experienced everything, you know. So then we come to yoga, and then we come to yoga making your body into a temple, finding the goddess, your kundalini, in your body, finding Vajradhara from the Buddhist point of view in your body, finding Shiva, who himself is a deity, yogi deity. Shiva is a total yogi deity. Krishna is a kind of yogi deity, although he's a little bit into sensual yoga. You know, Vishnu has all kind of other forms, but his most fun one is the Krishna one. Then they make Buddha into a Vishnu form, but that's by fine with the Buddhists. You know, Buddhists make Vishnu into a Buddha form, so they're happy. You know, they mutually inter embody in each other. That's so fine. That's one way of connecting. So Shiva, however, is an actual yogi. You know, he has it smeared with ash. He has a staff. You know, he's a total yogi, sadhu. You know, so this is non-dual yoga, and that's what you are doing actually. And your teachers were kind of scared of it because, you know, Indians were conquered for 1,000 years by outsiders. So the fact that India had become gentle, militarily vulnerable, and therefore the women less oppressed, and also with therefore beautiful music and aesthetics and things, and, you know, they had their own masters and Johnson, and, you know, like sex pleasurable things that they had that 1,000 years before the West. Or 1,500 years before, they were allowing that, and of all different kinds. So much so, even still in modern India, if you get married in a wedding and you don't have some sort of trans people celebrating and making a party and singing at your wedding, you won't be fertile. It won't be a fertile wet marriage. That's kind of weird that happened. That's it. Where did that come from? Came from a culture that became more interconnected, is how it came from, because of more yoga embedded in it. And what the name of the movement from which that yoga then came, the yoga where the body is considered sacred, that is Tantra. That is non-dualist in action, weaving a more happy world. Tantra comes from a word to weave, and words for threads and things, and weaving them together. And so this is where you should look for the source of what you're doing, and for the structure of the context within which it's most meaningful. And you know, and actually indirectly, even if you just do yoga for sport, for health, for social relationships, because you meet nice guys and girls in yoga centers, because they're people who are seeking to take responsibility for their own bodies. All of that is fine. You don't have to load it up with Hinduism or Buddhism. But in another way, if you want to go to the deeper levels of yoga, what is it that you're doing? There's no reason why you can't rediscover that for yourself. You know, it not doesn't have to be really, because really, India, even whether Hindu or Buddhist, was based on what they call adhyatma vidya, or inner science, you know, psychology, really, and, you know, somatopsychology, you know, neuropsychology, something like that, knowing how the body, the chakra, the whole system of chakras, the central channels, you know, the sensitivities of the different parts of the vagus nerve, the central nervous system, and so forth, and organizing the subtle body energies and things like that. India was far and away supreme in Eurasia on that. And that's because, only because India was wealthier. So people had more people in larger numbers that had the experience of gaining what the ordinary unthinking person thinks is the solution to all their problems, which is more wealth. They realized that however much wealth you have, it doesn't make you happy. In fact, past a certain point, it makes you more unhappy, because then you have to defend it and organize. You have to, if you're a king, kings are miserable. They have a little party here and there, but unless they lose the late kings in the decline of empires, ignore how they get to be kings, which is by managing things properly. And so they maybe have a little more decadent fun, and then somebody comes and kills them. And they're... regime is overthrown, you know. But the king that does a decent job of ruling is not happy, because it's a huge job, you know. It's like a billionaire today. Up to, you know, a few tens of millions, they're really happy getting more. Then it starts to steam or spiral. And then when they get up into the billions, they just have to make new organizations to manage it, and more stress on them, and more people coming after them to get it away from them. And it doesn't make them any happier at all. In fact, quite the opposite. Makes them more stressed out. They become like a single person government. And yet they don't have any agencies. You know, they have to create them. So never mind that. But the point is, you yogis, I'm talking to you yogis and yoginis, and how what you're doing is the art of interconnection. And this has to do with your livelihood and your choice of that. It has to do with your inner mental meditation, as well as your physical posture, you know, dance of enjoying your body and of keeping it free and open and healthy. And your, of course, what you eat and everything, every aspect of your life, you yoke to the purpose. And therefore, what gives you real motivation is the idea, not just that you're escaping from thought or escaping from the body, but that you're finding the best possible use of the body. You're finding love, actually. You're finding, and that doesn't mean sexuality, I mean love. Sexuality can be part of love. It can also be used hatefully. But it's a part of the vital energy of life, of course. And so there is an ultimate goal, in other words. And that ultimate goal is total good relating to everything in a total good way. And what is that? That's a loving way. And that doesn't mean indulging or being trampled by others and being injured by them and so forth. Too many people think compassion and love means that you become a victim. And in a way, you do accede to vulnerability, but only in the way that a martial artist does, if you really become a great yogi. Your martial artist is vulnerable, right? Because they don't aggress on their opponent. They let their opponent charge them, the adept martial artists, and then they let the aggression of the opponent turn back on itself by evading it, you see, rather than counter-aggressing the great martial artists. There may be some who punch just simply, you know, fight more effectively, but the great one, like the Aikido master, famous Japanese one, or others, they just dance out of the way and they let people crash into themselves. And so true love is capable like that, and true love can be fierce also. True compassion can be fierce against pain and against suffering. It can indulge in surgery. You know, like a truly loving surgeon is going to be the best surgeon because they really care about the health of the being that they have to cut open. Cutting open looks like aggressive. You know, sawing someone's breastbone to get in and try to fix their heart. But that's it. And the loving one will fix it right. They won't just casually just chuck in something and follow some method without caring because they want to rush off to go play golf or something, you know, just do it sloppily. They won't. Love means that they realize this is life and they cherish it and love it. And they'll be successful, if possible, as successful as possible in specific circumstances. Okay? So that's what you yogis are looking at. It doesn't mean you're all going to be doctors and surgeons. It doesn't mean you're all going to be any particular thing. You could be almost anything if you're a great yogi. It's unlikely you will be a soldier, but you might be a good self-defender. You could be a martial artist, for example, and a great yogi. That would be very doable, where you would be very, you know, preemptively defensive, let's say. Okay, so therefore, this is just being discovered. You know, the Hindu, Sir James Mallinson, and some other people, I can't remember the name, but I always remember Sir James' name, I never met him, and others are discovering whether Shaivite or Buddhist or Vaishnavite tantras or Shakti tantras, that the whole topic of tantra is getting a new treatment now. It was kind of something they were ashamed of in Victorian England-dominated India, which was, you know, Victorian, you know, like rigid, puritanical, self-suppressive, sex-repressed people, and that Indians had very strong knowledge of sensuality, and they even had these marvelous tantras, which, of course, were misunderstood as just an excuse for orgies, which they certainly are not. And there are some bad tantric gurus in this era who have pretended that is the case and have indulged in that and destroyed themselves and harmed their students by doing that. So it's not at all that. But on the other hand, there is some sort of artful way of being sexual, naturally, like anything else. There's a harmful way and there's a artful way. There's a loving way of being sensual, you know. So, and that's Tantra was aware of that and was fully, you know, competent about dealing with that. So that's the thing. And I want to do a lot more about that. This is probably long enough for one session, and I wandered and digressed, for which I'm sorry. But I'm talking about the birth, which is not just me giving birth to it. I think it's going to happen of multiple people. The birth of what one of my students, who's ahead of me in all of this, I think, really, it calls Vajra Yoga. I've been doing a lot with Kala Chakra, which is a particular tantra. I know I am personally sort of a Buddhist, a little bit not too, a bit lazy one, but I am, and I particularly adore the Kala Chakra Tantra, the Wheel of Time Tantra, because also it has a political dimension, which I feel responsible about, being a New Yorker and an American. But so I've been talking about Kala Chakra Yoga for some time, and I intend to continue with that, absolutely. But notice I'm using absolutely in a relatively emphatic way. But Vajra Yoga is more broad and encompasses any other kind of Buddhist tantra, and also any kind of Shaivite or Jain tantra or Kabbalistic tantra, Jewish tantra, or Christian tantra. In other words, the tantra means anybody who gets to a point where they realize that life is good and the world is good, which most religions, including forms of Buddhism and Hinduism, get you scared about life, and because they're trying to sell themselves as indispensable institutions to you. So they say, without us, you're going to have a horrible time even after death, much less, and also in life. And so that's not what the good strand, which is found in every human teaching, is that life is good. And therefore, your human embodiment is a wonderful creation, which you can take some credit for, because you were many other kinds of beings in your previous existence. And so to become truly human is to become enlightened, really, and which means fully loving and fully intelligent and wise and responsible for things going well in life. And so then you could then you get involved in tantra, which means then life becomes for you an art form. You try to weave out of the strands of your mind and your speech and your physical acts a fabric of joy and happiness and love of others and healing of other beings. That's what you try to do automatically. Whether you're Buddhist or Hindu or Christian or Jewish or Muslim or Taoist or whatever else we might, Baha'ist, whatever else we can dream up, humans can dream up, which will be infinite varieties. Within those categories, there are infinite varieties, of course, as well. There's many different kinds of Christians, Buddhists, Muslims, etc. So that's it. Vajra Yoga. And this is not the first, but I think this is the first systematic thing about Vajra Yoga. And I did digress a little in the beginning about politics, because we all have to be responsible in this country at this time and listen to Greta Thunberg's message. That's part of Vajra Yoga. Part of Vajra Yoga and part of weaving a fabric of a beautiful life for yourself and those you love, which you will find once you become more loving, that they are more than you think they are. You love more people than you thought you did. When you find that out, as you do that, you realize that social commitment and doing things for others in that sense, and even trying to keep alive the idea of democracy, which is this, as Churchill brilliantly said, it's the worst possible form of government, except for all the others. He really was quite bright in his own colonialist way. Meaning, it's impossible. Like, why it's worse? Because it's impossible. That is to say, a collective that is organized around the principle of the flourishing of each individual in the collective. Thomas Paine's beautiful simile of smashing a crown made of jewels and giving a shard of the jewel of the royal power to every single person in the community, so that they each have one shard of the responsibility of the king or queen. And that's what democracy is. That's a beautiful idea, although impossible, of course. And yet all the others could sometimes be good, but they tend to get really bad, is what Churchill meant. So, because of their different ways of concentrating power in fallible and poor yoga, non-yogi and yogini individuals, poorly connecting beings, in other words. And then those beings act recklessly because they have too much power. That's what he meant by except for all the others. So I don't consider it, even though talking about yoga, I don't consider it a digression to mention politics. But I will interweave the coming podcasts that are going on now with Vajra Yoga and Vajra politics. We did elect Barack Obama. We did elect Al Gore because, as a majority, we are aware of reality. let's simply. It's not like we're good, but we're aware of reality. And some of us, you know, have ancestors who were slaveholders, slave owners. And it was horrible. And we realized that. And even at the time, they realized it because they lost. That's how they lost. It isn't just socioeconomic. They lost because the people, human beings subliminally know, being vicious and violent and murderous is not good. You don't feel good about it. And you know, righteousness, in a sense, is really the essence of winning a war. Look, it's not machinery. Look at us, how we bombed the Vietnamese, how our stupid, bad people wrecked a whole country, filled it, you know, with the Agent Orange chemicals and filled like generations of trees with shrapnel. And I mean, we wrecked the whole place almost, killed millions of people. And yet they beat us in little black pajamas, crawling around in tunnels and carrying like some kind of old-fashioned weapons and some little bit newfangled one, but not really. Just, you know, just creeped around and kicked us out. There was a really helpful and salutary vision of that helicopter on top of the U.S. Embassy in Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon at the time. And just ran us out of town with all our machinery, because they were trying to be independent, and our stupid leadership, Nixon especially, before that, some stupid crazy generals manipulating Johnson, who was trying to be good in another way, but another way was a stupid cowboy. So, I mean, it's just really simple. It's just propaganda in the news. The aspect of this white supremacy thing that is torturing the United States right now and wrecking the world, actually, because of our position in the world of trying to uphold a basic human ideal in the midst of our colonialism and post-colonial colonialism, whatever. It is this propaganda in the media. The use of our brilliant technology of television and internet to brainwash people and to create them and remove them from being aware of reality, which was making them behave better when they were aware of it. But the majority was aware of it. Therefore, the majority did not elect W. Bush. The majority did not, they wouldn't have elected Reagan over Carter, actually, if they hadn't permitted treason. Reagan bribing the Iranians and manipulating people with propaganda and then empowering the Murdochs to create propaganda media. And then that propaganda created a whole bunch of people who are completely psychotic. It isn't that they're bad. They're nice. You know, so-called Hillary referred to them unwisely as deplorable. But what is deplorable is that they are so unrealistic. They've jumped into climate change denial, even though their own roofs are being lifted off by excessive tornadoes and their cellars are being flooded, and even their living rooms with their TV sets with Fox News on are being flooded. It's still not really happening, because their brains are attached to this technology that's being used, what used to be illegally before the Fairness Doctrine was canceled. Used to be illegal and will again be made illegal. So this is about, there's no mystery. Propaganda in media should be undone. It, of course, these current people who are benefiting from propaganda, like the current psycho person who has been saddled with the suffering of being president, don't think because he plays golf he's enjoying anything. He plays golf all the time because he hates doing it, actually, but he's stuck with it. And then he thinks that he's terrified that to have people punish him for all his misdeeds that he knows he's done. So it's like an African, you know, dictator any other dictator who will not be removed because the next dictator will kill them, they think. So they're like a cornered badger, you know. Bear cornered in a cave, they will fight to tooth and nail. But I just, we should at least remove the mystery. And like, if you know people and you want to converse with people who you seem to think are your opponents, what you have to do is you have to get them to stop watching the Fox propaganda. It's not news, it's propaganda. The opinion. Opinion delivered without counter-opinion should return to being illegal, which it is, it was, when we had the Fairness Doctrine ruled the government's doling out of bandwidth to corporations. They could not express opinion without the counter-opinion present to counter the propagandistic force coming at you with multicolored media and loud voice directly into your head and into your brain with lies. This is what has done it. So this has to be traced back and it has to be modified as soon as possible. And of course, the best person to do it would be Lachlan and James, brothers, to do it themselves right now and realize that it's not healthy for them. It's destroying the world, actually, to have a huge section of the population of a country with a large role due to its technology and due to its past tradition of freedom and individualism. It's to allow the large portion of them to be completely walled off from what's really happening and acting as if it was 150 years ago. And they could be winning a civil war or something. And they could be like supreme or something. Again, you know, and just destroy everybody else, which of course they don't really want to do it, but they're created there. It's a reality where they kind of have to. It's made it out to them to be like a vital survival thing, you see, because of the unreality in which they are living. This is the topic of this particular short thing. I'm not sure where we'll fit it, but this is what I wanted to say today. And it's not Buddhist, it's not spiritual, it's political. But it's very, very urgent. And at least if you know what is the source of this, if you try to get clear, don't get confused. Be clear. What is the source of nice neighbors and perfectly decent people becoming like monstrous in what they're doing and allowing monstrosities to occur? We have been a country, America has been a country that people have fled to from oppression throughout the world, not just out of greed, but for survival, to get away from torture, to get away from thought control. You know, the Soviet Union collapsed because they crushed all their creative individuals because they just wanted to control by ideology. You know, a place like Venezuela is being destroyed like that. Dictatorships are terrible. Our country, the U.S., which is also belongs to the Lakota people, the Iroquois people, the Hopi people, etc., all of the different native people, as much as it does to any of the Euro-American people who've been born here, belongs to all of them. The black people who were brought here as slaves, but now are supposedly free, theoretically free. They're still tortured and oppressed too much, and that has not been repaired, just like the native people have not been repaid for the theft of all of their wealth and lands. But there is a strand of us that is good, that works toward that. And people come from all over the world to seek shelter here. They have been doing so for a long time. And then in a way, you could say our expansion after having to fight the terrible wars of the 20th century, yes, you can see it as our own neocolonialism. But there's an element where we need other countries to allow people to be happy. So like the Carter thing about human rights was correct, because otherwise there people will flee, and now we've reached the limit of how much people can flee. We do have room. It's not like fake like him with his wall, But, you know, there is a limit. So we have to look at the source of why they're fleeing and try to fix it and help it. And the climate is a major problem, therefore, we have to deal with the climate as an emergency. And we have to deal with dictatorships as emergencies. And we've been failing and failing since we've been brainwashed, since a core people, a certain number of our people have been brainwashed by this evil propaganda thing, which revived this old thing under the false idea that that would allow a certain minority to have great wealth. But now they have what they don't even want it. And they're under a state of threat. Societies worldwide are blowing up about it all. So it is an emergency. It's a global emergency. We have to, fact, science, reality has to be the topic of all media. No more of this incredible lies can be allowed. That is not censorship. The correction of lies is not censorship. The correction of lies is humane activity, not to create crazy people who are misinformed about what their life is and what the world is and what their neighbor is. This is not allowed now. And that's not censorship. It's not a matter of taste. It's a matter of facts. There are no alternative facts. There's just the facts. And so we're all responsible for this from now, to speak up, to let it be known. And, you know, this poor man who is currently being impeached, but who is doing so much harm, thrashing around, the impeachment should be preventing him from doing such harm. But it's clearly not. To have us have allies, the brave and generous Kurdish people and their women who took responsibility and died by the thousands. We lost 5 soldiers. They lost 11,000 in getting rid of fanatics of the caliphate. And to have this crazy person whose decisions are supposedly to be respected by confused and deluded people, suddenly betray them and hand them over to another deluded person, which is not even benefiting the Turkish people at all. That deluded person has only been put in there by the same kind of distortion of the modern instrument of mass media. Fake populist use of mass media, telling them lies. So it's like a disease that's larger than our country, but the beginning of correcting it is up to us. And of course it will be, the Turkish people themselves will, of course, inevitably eventually revolt against that crazed person. As you know, everybody did. The Russians got rid of Soviet Union eventually. But it's too delicate now. And the climate is like Mother Earth is speaking to us. And it is intensifying these things to the degree where we must act as if it is an emergency. And it begins by correcting the reality view of people, letting them know what is going on. And the people who should take the lead are those who created this unrealistic propagandistic thing. The petroleum industry people, the petro addicts, the oil addicts, and the media people who have been their mouthpieces. It is their responsibility. They should be reversing themselves and taking the lead. And I appeal to them to think about it. Well, how do they want to be pictured in history? because it all will become clear eventually, if we survive. And do they really want to be in a position of seeking destruction to avoid thinking that way to avoid responsibility? There may be some as extreme as that. But then they, as that lady Michelle Alexander brilliantly said, who was appalled by the cruelty she found in studying mass incarceration, which is the kind of race thing that has been going on for 40 years. With great intensity, I mean, always, but particular intensity of 40 years since the civil rights movement, actually, the reaction against it is about 40, 50 years intensification. She said, I wish the people believed, she puts it as believed in their own future life, because then that would moderate their cruelty and their irresponsibility. I don't even believe it myself, she said, which is very honest of her. And I can say, I'm a Buddhist, and I know all the logic of the multiple life theory. And I also know that no theory about the relative is absolute, which Buddha freely admitted to as a scientist. And I know that it's still, nevertheless, within relative theories, it's the most logical and the most contextually appropriate. But even I don't really live as if I'm fully aware of the future life, because I'm brought up in a culture of devil may care, go for the gold, go for the Budweiser, go for it, recklessness, you know, just be reckless. I grew up like racing cars on roads where I could have killed myself and others like 10 times over. And so I have the kind of ingrained sense she wants belief in. It's not a matter of belief in, as if it was a mysterious or mystical thing. It's a matter of common sense. Everything is a continuity. Every time I went to sleep my whole life, I woke up again. And I had dreams, good and bad, depending on how I had lived in the days previous. So I've had experience of when I think I'm releasing consciousness, it keeps coming back. And that has been my experience. So why should death be so different? Who assured anybody that nothing is there and they're going to be nothing? Whoever did it was lying to them, because it wasn't a scientific assurance. Because nothing is nothing. So therefore, it's not a place you go. So any continuity of any energy, such as your awareness, can never be nothing. Being unconscious, it's only a temporary state, and you'll be conscious again. So you can't hope for destruction to get you out of, you know, those who, out of great shame or embarrassment, when they lose the war, then kill themselves. They didn't get out of the disgrace of the loss by doing that. And those were even cultures which had Buddhism present, Buddhist science in it, but they still were not really aware of the reality. Harakiri, for example. And the huge number of suicide we have now in this country. Because people just don't feel well the way they're living. But that can all be corrected. Okay, so this was all my main point, is the media is responsible now. And it's so ironic that the product of the truly fake media, the propaganda media, tries to accuse what's left of the realistic media, trying to report what's actually happening in the world, although badly constrained by money not to report the climate role in things, for example, and so on. So even that, there's an element of fake in the actual media. But there's still some effort there. It's ironic that the product of the fake one calls the other ones fake. It's just typical. We've reached 1984 at last, 40 years late, 35 years late. Okay? Thank you very much.
Bob Thurman podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, like, and repost on your favorite social media platforms. Tashi Lulek, and thanks for tuning in.